mil estrelas, que cata brilhar, linda mar, boeu areia, que cata moiar, espaiol desse mundo fora, sol rote mar, terra pôr, cheio de amor, tem morna, tem coladeira, terra sal, cheio de amor, tem batu, tem funaná. Espanhol nesse mundo fora, só Rotimar, terra povo cheio de amor. Tem morna, tem coladeira, terra povo cheio de amor. Tem batu, tem funaná. Oi, tanto saudade, saudade, saudade. Oi, tanto saudade, saudade sem fim. Oi, tanto saudade, saudade, saudade. Oi, tanto saudade, saudade sem fim.
That's the Barefoot Diva herself, called so by reason of her well-known trait of performing in her bare feet. That's the late Cesaria Evora from Cap Verde with Petit Pays, a tribute to her humble and beloved homeland off the coast of West Africa. It's from her 1995 album, Cesaria. She's known for her morna music, as they call it, a blend of sweetness and sorrow. She died in 2011 at the age of 70. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. It is Tuesday, March the 31st. And yes, it is Free Your Mind Tuesday. We're making up. I did promise that we would, and this is a day that it's a makeup day. 888-874-4888 is the number to call, and we are talking once again with each other, trading very valuable information. You get to take the conversation wherever you want it to go, but be prepared. People would be taking you on, or people would be commenting on what you say. So, of course, you will exercise all due precautions to make sure that what you say is solid. 888-874-4888. Quite a few things in the news, but this is the time for you to offer your insights, your analysis, your concerns, your opinions, your take on things. So why don't you do that? Give us your take. How about that? On the issues of the day and whatever you think is worthy of further inspection. Quite a few things that I think should come to mind, because we've been talking so much about all these different stories, and we aren't nearly scratching the surface with the volume of things to talk about, as it is the case all throughout the media. 888-874-4888. Just want to remind you a couple of things while the calls come in. We are reconstituting ourselves, and that means that the Lead Stories family has a little bit of work to do, and that is to alert all others, especially those in your specific circles, that we're back and that they should tune in, and you would want to pass the word on to them. I need you to let me see evidence that you're doing your work on the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. It's a wonderful way to begin to build. We passed the 500,000 mark of downloads, and that means that people are listening. But frankly, it is all the more remarkable because we haven't really done a major push in terms of getting the word out about the program and about PRN. So on these two missions about PRN and about Lead Stories, I need to enlist your help to get the word out to those people that who are in your circles that we are back and that we should again recongregate, regather, and begin the process of picking up from where we left off. All right, so I need, if each of you reaches out to at least 10 people that you know, we will be able to do that. We will be able to get back up to steam faster than you know. Also, let them know that they can download the program on the archives at any time, at leadstories@podbean.com, also, of course, on the PRN website. But you can always tune in to PRN at your convenience because the programs are archived. And so you could listen at any time, and I want that also to be known. All right, so that's the homework. The homework is outreach. It's only going to cost you a little bit of time, a couple of minutes to send notes to the people in your circle and let them know that we're back and that we are regathering and be back on track. Okay? So let's begin. 888-874-4888. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, greetings, you three.
Oh, my. Time for a party. It is Sarah from Dallas.
Yes, ma'am. Greetings to you and the PRN audience. It's been a minute or two, I must say.
I missed you. I don't know if you missed me, but I certainly did miss you.
I sure missed you, but you made a friend when you had on Dr. Gerald Horn and Attorney Maddox and a few outstanding scholars that were on there. So you made up for the gremlins taking over the radio station and dismantling it. But yes, ma'am. But you three, since we're closing out Women's History Month for the month of March, the last day in March, I must say that I have three of my sheroes I will make a quick mention of, because right now I'm reading the biography of Mrs. Ella Baker and by Barbara Ransby. So if the listeners out there would like to get a hold of this book, it's Barbara Ransby, and it's called Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement. And it's going, you know, she's one of our unknown sheroes that you don't hear much mention of, but she was very instrumental, Mrs. Ella Baker, as well, of course, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer and Mrs. Ida B. Wells Barnett. Those are my three sheroes that I'm going to make quick mention of for the month since we're closing out Women's History Month. But what I wanted to free my mind on, you Tracy, is quite a lot, but I'm going to have to hold some in and let it out at some other time. This situation that transpired, this in Oklahoma, and I was watching several news clips, and I have friends of mine was texting me and sending me clips of all of that stuff. And this shuffling move that was made by the Oklahoma Congressional Black Caucus, Legislative Black Caucus, the black preachers, as well as some of members of the Black Students Union of Oklahoma University, when this young man, Levi Pettis, I think his name is, he's from right up here in Dallas, because this boy graduated from a very prestigious academy. He lives he came out of Highland Park. And for those of you who don't know the history of Highland Park here in Dallas, this was one of those sundown towns where you could not be caught there if you were black after sundown. It only recently removed this restrictive covenant to allow non-whites to start buying real estate. And that only happened within the past 15 years because it's a predominantly all-white, very moneyed enclave. George Bush Jr. lived there, as well as Dick Cheney. That's where they used to stay in Highland Park out here in Dallas. And this boy graduated from a preparatory school, which is very expensive, and the tuition to go there per year, it costs as much as most college tuition per year for you to go to one of those good schools in the anywhere in the United States. So for these people, and you see, this is the thing that has been setting us back, you treat, and I've been saying this over and over again. We're the only ethnic group that allow our preachers to lead a movement. And I'm sick and tired of it. I'm going to quote the Sister Fannie Lou Hamer. I am sick
before you go off there, tell us what is the premise that you're arguing today? What is the issue that you're bringing forward today? The point of contention.
What I'm bringing forward today, Amutrice, is we have abused this youth of this apology when white people get into trouble and they know that they have really screwed up royally, they always like to go and find a black group or somebody black who can vouch for them and provide them cover. This is a wash, rinse, repeat cycle that we've been going through. And I've seen it happen repeatedly because it happened in Atlanta where this white man beat up this veteran, this army veteran, this black woman coming to the Cracker Barrel restaurant. And what did he do? He went and hired a black attorney to represent him to say he's not a racist. And this stuff has been continuously going on with us. You treat these people, play us better than a cheap violin. Because whenever they mess up, they go to the black church, they go to the NAACP, the Urban League, or whatever so-called black institution we have, and like we did with Donald Sterling, you know, pay some money, and all of a sudden they came up behind him holding hands and was standing up on that podium with that boy. First of all,
wait a minute. What? So let me just say, why? What is the issue here? If they can't do it, these things can't be done unless other people agree to be used this way.
Exactly.
So you can't attack the person or the individuals looking to expunge themselves of blame. However they can do it, it is in their interest to do that. So
exactly. I'm not blaming, but
it's not just the preachers. It's the politicians. It's the heads. I just talked about the National Urban League just last week. But we have this is a continued cycle. So what is it that you think needs to be done? Because it is a practical matter. If you are in trouble and it looks like it's going to be long-term trouble because these things have a way now of just simmering in the background, and then 10 years, 15 years from the time that the incident happens, it surfaces. So they're now onto the idea of doing damage control preemptively. Now,
what I'm saying is this. When you see, an apology is only given if you are genuinely sorry and come. Without apology, come reparative.
Come on. You really think anybody is genuinely apologetic? If they were genuinely apologetic, we wouldn't even know. I mean, the fact that they have to call the news conference to tell you how genuinely apologetic they are is a clue that they're not genuinely apologetic.
That's why I'm saying you treat.
I understand your anger. I share it. However, I'm still asking you the question: What should be the response?
We need to have a group to come up to denounce it and says, you know, I don't know what they're doing. You know, we do not agree with nothing that was said at this news conference. They do not represent the entirety of the black community. We do not sanction it because these political officials and these preachers and whatever, they're an embarrassment. Because this boy, like I keep saying, you treat these racists that are running around here, these are not 70-year-old men about to die that are doing these things. He's 19 years old. Where did he learn this from? It had to come out of the home, the environment that he came from, that he learned this from. This is a learned behavior that comes out from the home and the circles that he moves within. So we're always seeing these old people that are doing it, but you find more racism is happening in the high school levels and in the colleges and all of these levels where this stuff is going on with these children, where they are doing these racist actions. And for them, because first of all, Rich, they should abandon it, because when the reporter asked him, well, can you tell us who taught you to chant? Well, this is not about about me doing anything. You know, but right then and there, I would have said, you know, well, hold up, wait 1 minute. If you can't come clean and say who else is involved and who taught you this, then all bets are off, and they should have all turned their back and walked out the room and even been standing there by himself. Because you can't use me to come up there, and, you know, they're all standing up there looking at him and bobbing their head and look like a... This is the worst kind of step and fetch show in 2015 that I've seen. I was so disgusted. I didn't even want to watch the whole thing because I had to shut it down. Because they send my blood pressure up because I'm saying over and over again. This is going to
blood pressure up. Look, here's the thing. Part of this whole plan as well, when people do these kinds of things, we're clear about what the intention is. The attention is to save their butts. It still has nothing to do with actually educating society. It has nothing to do with the redemptive value of genuine contrition. It has nothing to do with promoting peace and justice. It just has to do with saving the person's butt. But that's all that, that's all that is. Yeah. The continued, so I'm not blaming them for doing that. That's a form of self-protection and self-survival. I see mm-hmm. that. The question we still come to is what do we do as a community with the people who continue to transact business in our name without qualification, without the right to do so, and clearly without the proper intention. They obviously have some other motive other than this business of surrounding somebody with love and you know, doing the redemptive thing, you know, like when Bill Clinton was in his little trouble there.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, a whole battalion of black preachers led by Jesse Jackson, I mean, went down there, and in the eyes of the public, they staged this whole thing. They put hands on the man and said, you know, in the name of Jesus, you will develop a real sound moral character. I mean, the big joke, of course, was that they really needed also to lay hands on each other, but that's a whole other thing.
They don't need to lay hands. You still need to put foot up there behind, because Jack was doing more than laying out of hands while he was laying hands on Bill Clinton. Because
this is an internal problem. And I always say that the community is lax when it refuses to vocalize these kinds of sentiments, and it refuses to call these folks out on asking them, who are you to conduct this business in anybody's name? Who are you? And what right do you have to do that? And if you want, I mean, if you want to get into all of this theatrical stuff with your news conferences and all of this stuff, you know, really try and do that quietly where nobody sees it. Because if it's really genuine, we wouldn't see it. We really wouldn't see
it. Exactly. You, Therese, that's what I said, because the woman that was there, she was a state senator. She's an Oklahoma state senator. And I said to myself, I said, the people in her district, they need to go ahead and put her out of office. Because I'm sure she didn't consult with her constituent before she decided to take this upon herself and get with and do this clown show that she and these other these preachers and these other black student union members, they did. They're a total embarrassment. This was an embarrassment as for you to be a public official, and for you to do something like that, because all this child is trying to do, he's trying to get back into the university, clean up his reputation, and he's going to use you, black people, as usual, like they've always done, to wash themselves clean. And I'm sick and tired of them doing this. I'm sick and tired of being the laughing stock of the entire planet. Everybody abused and abused us, and it keeps on going. And because, like attorney automatic says, we have no damn ethics, we have no code of conduct, no standards in our community. Because if we did, we would punish our own internally, and this would not keep happening over and over again. These people
Point
need to
made.
Be punished.
Point made. Thank you so much, Sarah, for calling.
You're welcome,
and
Therese.
Welcome back home. Thank you so much. You're on the air. It's PRN.FM.
Hi, Utrecht. This is Joel from
Hello.
New York.
This is who?
Joel from New York.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
Hi. You know, I think there's a little reverberation here. Let me turn my speakerphone off, if you please.
Thank you.
How's that? Hello?
Yes. Listening to you.
Hello?
Listening to you.
Okay. You know, I thought I'd address the Israeli election today, if that's all right. We heard a lot about it about a week or so before the election took place, and then a few things afterwards, and then it was over once the drama of Netanyahu's visit to Washington ended. So, as usual, the elections were reported by the mainstream media in such a way as to give the impression that something happened that didn't. So I'd like to address all of that. And My feeling about the election is that as you look at the way the election was run in Israel, the electoral options, in many ways, reminded me of the United States, where national elections and increasingly all kinds of elections are really not about nothing. They're not about issues. They're about values, as these politicians might put them, or personalities. And same thing happened in Israel. And most of the electoral options, except for one that I'll mention at the end, ran from bad to worse, from out-and-out xenophobia to usual racism that we see in Israeli political life. But there are essentially three main blocks that took part in this election. The first one, which was headed by Netanyahu, wishes to maintain the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in its current form, preferably with no negotiations, in a situation that vacillates between open and cold war. The second bloc, which ran, wished to sort of dance with the conflict, to negotiate, and negotiate as if there were no tomorrow, just for the purposes of negotiation. And for the third bloc, there's no conflict at all. The elections are about the middle class and what it means to be an Israeli. So the elections didn't really promise anything, hardly, and were hardly about anything. And all of these Jewish parties that ran, all of the parties in Israel that ran, except the party called the bloc called Meretz, M-E-R-E-T-Z, which is kind of left-wing bloc, which is against the occupation, all the other parties in Israel share a desire to show that they have the guts to stand up for Israel vis-a-vis international law and that they are anti-Arab. But by the way, the term Palestinian was never used except for the Arab List, the one democratic force that ran, but more about that later. And the reason why the word Palestinian isn't, you always hear the word Arab used in this relationship, never the word Palestinian, so as to divorce the whole issue from any kind of historical context. And the first bloc, of course, is run by Netanyahu. He was the maestro of the first bloc, and he showed great effort to demonstrate that he doesn't give a damn about the Israel-U.S. relationship. That's why he insisted on speaking to Congress when no one, you know, from Obama and AIPAC even wanted him there. Now, the second bloc is kind of interesting. It's headed by a group that called themselves the Zionist Union, and they consisted to a large extent of former Netanyahu ministers in the ministry, in the previous ministry. The leaders were Zvi Levni, who was the justice minister, and Isaac Herzog, who was the head of the Labor Party, who came into the coalition. In Israel, you've never had anything but coalition government, so that's why that happened. So they were members of the previous government, but they decided to run against him, and they were in love with negotiations. They couldn't wait to topple Netanyahu because they longed for what they call a peace process. Not an actual peace, obviously, not the return to a single, Palestinian-Israeli state of some kind or another, but they didn't want any negotiation on Jerusalem, which they regard as the united and undivided capital of the Jewish people. That was Livni's point, her major point, as she campaigned over the past few weeks. They didn't want any compromise on Israel's full security control of the Jordan Valley, the occupied West Bank, which is the most arable land in Israel and has the best aquifers. And they promoted themselves as two humane politicians, Livni and Herzog, who would be flying to Washington again, shaking hands with the U.S. president. They imagine themselves, you know, eating croissants and muffins when hurrying to an important meeting in Paris. In other words, they were going to be responsible, whereas their counterpart, Netanyahu, wasn't. But really, the policy is the same. So really, what they wanted to do was to rehabilitate Israel's image in the eyes of the world without in any way doing anything concretely different from what Netanyahu did. And the third
is why, during the whole election, the tone was really, we're going to avoid the conflict, the obvious key point to life in the region, which is the conflict. But they astutely avoided it and decided that they were going to concentrate instead on the economy. And it just was a very interesting approach. Here you are, smack in the middle of a raging conflict, and they decided that, well, we're going to set that aside for the moment, because obviously they agreed with the hard line of Netanyahu, and so Netanyahu gave them a way of having him take the lead on that, and then they decided, well, we'll talk about the economy.
But, Eucharist, there's a hidden message in that as well, because like everywhere else, you know, we're suffering through a worldwide global economic contraction. We're in the beginnings of a massive deflationary spiral. Anybody who's looking can see that. But the reason why there's a hidden message to that is because when you become a proponent of settlements, remember that a great majority of people who are going to those settlements are not crazed Zionists from Milwaukee or from Bentonhurst. They are Israelis who are having a hard time finding homes. This is a housing bubble in Israel, the same kind of problems that we have here. And this is the answer. I mean, this is subsidized homes. There are many, many, many deals that middle-class, lower-middle-class, and even working-class people can get. So in order for any kind of improvement to occur to, let's say, the ordinary lives of Israelis, such as having a better housing situation, you also then have to become a proponent of the settlement policy. So that never disappears. Anyway, the third block that I wanted to mention is run by this guy, Yair Lapid, L-A-P-I-D, and he's a media personality. He has a party called the Yesh Atid Party, and he has really emerged in a dramatic fashion in the last 3 years, and his view is it doesn't matter whether there are 400,000 or 500,000 Israeli settlers. It doesn't matter, and this is closer to what you were saying, that we should worry about Gaza, which Israel has been under siege for 8 years and may explode tomorrow. We don't have to worry about that. We have to deal with the difficulties of, consumption, the difficulties of housing, difficulties in employment, but he never mentioned anything specific. And the reason for that is because Israel, over the last 9 years, has moved into a neoliberal position. So there's never going to be any kind of real social activism on the part of any kind of these governments. So those are the three blocks, but there is one positive outcome. And as in a good Bible story, the former foreign minister of the government, the last government, Avigdor Lieberman, who runs his own party called the Yisrael Betanu Party, which is a near-fascist party, he suggested raising the electoral threshold from 2% to 3.25% as a way of excluding all of the Arab parties. And as a result, the Arab parties and the few Jewish sympathizers they had joined together, reformed themselves as a kind of what they call themselves the Joint List, you may have heard of, and they may now be the third largest presence in the next parliament. And they're headed by a young leader named Ayman Odeh, O-D-E-H, and the party line is that it's against another war in Gaza, calls for an end to the occupation, and it actually uses the word occupation. Try to find it anywhere in Israeli media. Maybe you'll find it in Gideon Levy's columns and the rest, but that's about it. And it actually says that ending the occupation will be a step towards peace, and it actually uses the word peace. And it calls on Jews and Arabs in Israel to unite against racism and discrimination. It calls for a coalition of Arabs and Mizrahi, the Jews who were born in North Africa, alike. And it positions itself on the left and actually uses the word left. And in a country where only 17% of the people openly support the left, which in my view means liberals in this case, that's really a bold program. And so their call for a true partnership and a fight for a just and equal society as well as a peaceful end of the conflict is a hope for the future. And they're the only really democratic hope. Yet for them to be a significant part of a coalition in the Knesset, Jewish Israelis will have to start seeing the Arab-Palestinian Israelis as equal citizens, as legitimate political partners, and until that happens, we're doomed to more wars and more killing and to the indifferent choice between the politicians who represent the three blocs that I mentioned.
But we have to be real, too. Well, I mean, what you say is a really, it sounds good, and it is a great desire. But the issue is you have to also go by history. History has shown, first of all, that the actual philosophy undergirding the formation and the founding of this state of Israel is predicated on the annihilation of the people there. I mean, we can't get around that. You've got to utterly control them, take their land, take their homes, take their resources, just relegate them, just get them out, dispossess them by any means, because this is the fundamental philosophy that guides this drive called Zionism. I mean, you have a concept, you back it up with this biblical notion that God gave you this land, and you could come from all different disparate parts of the world and basically come home to the land given to you by God. And therefore, whoever is in the way really deserves to be moved out of the way. And you know, what we have, I mean, it's good that we have this kind of promise coalition, but really, they're not structurally dealing with the problem. The problem is that this country, just like the United States, founded on white supremacy. Nobody wants to deal with this as a reality. This is the reality. So, I mean, at different points in our history, we move the chess pieces over here and we move a chess piece over there, but there is no structural eradication of this crazy idea that, you know, there.
Well, that's why, Patrice, that's why
it's my God to do this. The funny part is that the Zionists, for the most part, are atheists. But that's all right. That's a whole other argument. Go ahead.
Well, I certainly agree with you that we can't hope for any kind of change within a kind of Zionist configuration. But for the first time, this is the first time in Israeli history, that political history, that we've ever seen this. And given the fact that the Zionist parties themselves and the Zionist leadership is deeply preoccupied with what they call the demographic time bomb, in a few years, the total Palestinian population will be larger than the total Israeli population from the Mediterranean through to the Jordan Valley, through the whole of Israel-Palestine. So this really represents the first attempt to create an anti-Zionist front and to give it legitimacy because it has strength within the Knesset itself. And as the third largest party, it has some political punch. Now, the question now is, will they be able to sustain and maintain their organization, given the fact that you now have another right-wing government in power, because it's really the first bloc that I mentioned that's in power now. There will probably be an attempt to produce legislation that will try to raise the electoral threshold again and suppress this group. I imagine that will come along with a lot of other racist legislation that's going to come as well to consolidate the settlement policies. Because, by the way, this is all about settlements. In fact, even the war about Iran is not about it. Every time Netanyahu, over the last 22 years, when he was foreign minister 22 years ago, when he first became prime minister in the 90s, every time he raises the issue of an Iranian nuclear weapon, the Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, issues a statement saying that they're not doing it, you know, just to cover themselves. Why does he do it again? Because we know that the Iranians aren't really a nuclear threat to the one nuclear power in the region, Israel, which has anywhere between 100 and 200 nuclear weapons. The reason why they do it is to take the mind off what you were talking about before, which is to continue the 60-year history of ethnic cleansing, which has been going on since 1947. So it really is a hope, and it is the first time this has ever happened. The thing that I find so interesting is that Jews are willing to join this group as well. And I think that as the situation becomes more untenable and as the economic situation declines in Israel as well, we may see some action here. We can't see any kind of hope through, and that's the other point I was trying to make, that when corporate news accounts give the impression that the opposition to Netanyahu in some way represented a progressive alternative to this deep reactionary policy that's all kafla. And we have to turn to anti-Zionist groups, and we finally have one. And now the question is, will it be allowed to deliver its message? And if it does deliver its message, it's going to increase its remember, there are many, many Palestinians living in Israel proper, not in the West Bank of Gaza, but within Israel proper, and they vote. And if they can be mobilized, and if more and more disconcerted Jews can join them, they could represent the beginnings of a force for change and also put pressure on outside politicians to begin to mollify their stand.
Well, I still come to the idea that the question still looms large. What is going to be done about the undergirding philosophy here, which is Zionism? All of the actions
Zionism will have to end. If this third group ever achieves political prominence, that's the end for the Zionist state. I mean, I think it's going to end anyway. Once the Israeli Jews are the minority in Israel, they have two choices. Either they can grant the Palestinian majority full citizenship right in a unified country, or they can suppress them. If they suppress them, the UN Charter gives Palestinians the right to revolt so that they can, you know, achieve their rights. So one way or the other, you're either going to get a federated state, binational state of one kind, or you're going to get war. And I can tell you what Netanyahu and what the message of most of the people who voted for him is, and then I'll get off. Netanyahu is saying either you acquiesce to the status quo, you won't get full citizenship rights, but you live, you migrate, or you stay and fight and die. Those are the three choices the Zionists are giving the Palestinians. Of course, they're untenable. So, and of course, any kind of physical response to the Israelis is going to be very, very difficult, as we've seen. That's why this kind of political response fills me with a certain amount of hope.
Well, great points today, Gerald. Thank you so much for your call. Thank you. 888-874-4888. Very substantive calls, as usual, on Lead Stories today. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Harvey from Berkeley.
Hello, Harvey. How are you?
Very good. And how are you, wonderful Utrice?
Thank you, wonderful Harvey. What have you to say today?
Well, first of all, your phone is a little scratchy, so I just want you to know that because I know you can't hear it.
So sorry about that.
No problem. well, what I want to talk about is, you know, you talked about the laying on of hands earlier, and something in that vein. It turns out that I was listening to another talk show, and the gentleman who had the talk show, he was like a lawyer, and he invited this woman on who wrote a book about how she healed people, how she used her energy to heal people and help make them better and so on and so forth. And he really put her down. He said, you know, you can't prove that to me. And she said, well, I've done it for so long, and I know that people feel better after. He said, you can't prove it. Maybe they just healed themselves. There's no proof. And he just sort of treated her like as though she was in the box, and we, the audience, was the jury. And he cross-examined her back and forth. And at the end, I'm sure she was sorry she went on the show, because he didn't really make her, didn't really believe in what she was doing or build her up or anything like that, or tell, you know. So at the end, I called them up and I said, you know, there are certain people who have powers. Like when I went to school, I used to know this guy. You can give him like a series of four numbers, like 5,282. You can get an endless list of them, and the moment you stop, he gives you the sum. I don't know how he does it. He also has the ability, if you tell him your birthday, he tells you the day it falls on. And I met this other guy who never took a piano lesson in his life, doesn't know how to read music. You name the tune, he sits down and plays it. I don't know how he does that. So I know that there are people with a lot of different capabilities. And then he said, well, I'll give you another minute to prove your point. So I suddenly thought of something in the real world that this guy couldn't say no to. There is a force called, there's a something called inductive charging. It's known as wireless charging, and it uses an electromagnetic field to transfer energy between two objects. Like, for instance, when you put your toothbrush in the holder, that's inductive charging. You're not really plugging your toothbrush in. Or I think the Energizer, they sell something called a tablet, where they plug the tablet in, and then when you put your cell phone down on it or various devices, it charges them up without plugging them in. So I thought, since inductive charging exists in the real world, perhaps there's something called inductive healing, where on the metaphysical level, people can pass their energy, they can sort of help another person who has low energy through inductive healing, through inductive charging, through the transfer of healing energy from one person to another. So I think that because there is inductive charging in the real world, that there is the possibility of inductive healing in the metaphysical world.
Great idea. I mean, it's something to think about. And, you know, as you see in many, many societies, where even from birth, there's this practice of putting hands on the child and transferring energy, and it calms the child down. It strengthens them, they say. And, you know, it looks like a massage in some cases, but it's actually the transferring of energy. And especially in Eastern countries, there's this whole thing about the laying on of hands, even from birth. So it's a very interesting idea, very interesting to think about.
Well,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Calling, and I'm so glad that you're back. But it sounded like you have some more to say.
Well, no, I mean, that's basically, I was just going to say that, you know, you hear people say sometimes, you know, when they're with somebody, they feel so drained afterwards. And so that's the energy going the wrong way. But I believe that, you know, with if we use our positive energy, that each and every one of us has the ability to transfer that energy and help other people improve their immune system and build and get better.
Well, thank you very much for your call today, Hari. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Therese. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 888-874-4888. Hello, you're on the air. This is Lead Stories on PRN.
The meeting on Wednesday. I'll call you back.
Hello?
Hi, is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, thanks. This is Mike from PG County, Maryland.
Okay, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well. And I just wanted to say good afternoon to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
You're welcome. I've been just sitting here patiently listening to everyone's viewpoints. And first, I just want to say this. First of all, it's not right. It's not right for a very small segment and group of people to wield such an inordinate amount of influence and power over the rest of the people on the planet. I just wanted to get that out of the way because it just doesn't seem right to me. But I just wanted to call and, one, make this very important point. And I'm trying not to see things in terms of color or race or all these other kind of like fabricated notions that have been kind of driven into us. But there was this story about an Indian gentleman who was a grandfather taking a walk in an Alabama neighborhood. I don't know if you heard about this.
Yes.
And they called and said that there was actually a strange black man walking in the neighborhood. They couldn't tell the difference.
Suspicious person, yes.
Right. So the end result was this guy was paralyzed by the police, right? And just this week, it was announced that there was a civil rights indictment against the police officer and that the police officer is going to be charged, right? Now, I want us to juxtapose that. This Indian gentleman who was slammed to the pavement and within a month's time got a federal civil rights indictment. And yet, we have seen the murder of these unarmed black men And I can't recall a civil rights indictment being levied against any police officer in any of those cases. And I try to use this as an illustrative point to drive home the fact that you, like Alton Maddox has stated, that you as a so-called African-American have no legal rights. That, to me, stated it clear, just clearly.
What do you think, as for example, when you raise this as an example, are you saying that, in fact, that there was something at work that caused the indictment on one hand and the other?
Absolutely.
Both individuals are seen as non-white individuals. So how could you make this distinction now?
There absolutely was some other forces at play. That Indian gentleman had what they call sovereignty. He had a nation behind him. The nation of India has an embassy. That embassy contacts our embassy, and they pressure officials, and they get what they want. They have sovereignty. And this all goes back, it's all historical. We should understand that. This is all historical. That's why all of these little, and you pointed this out last week, when you talked about the Urban League and their reports, and all these reports basically saying the same thing. These organizations are not here to help us. And I'm so glad I've lived this long to be able to clearly state this, that anything in this system which is not opposed and directly working to dismantle it is against us. Anything that's supporting the system, that there's no ifs and buts about it. This system, this capitalist, so-called capitalist, democratic system, is the enemy of us all. It is no. I've never been clear on anything else in my life. And the statistics bear it out because everybody in our community, and I'm speaking of black people, but I shouldn't be just speaking of black people because really it's about poor people. If you look at it, the statistics bear it out. The poor people are actually losing what little bit they were able to accumulate, the crumbs that they were able to accumulate, and it's all being taken away just systematically across the board, whether you're talking about jobs or wealth, or, you know, any of the measures that they use to declare you, you know, a middle-class American or whatever. If you look at it, all of them are being decimated by the so-called elites. And the consolidation is, it's just accelerating at this point. So when I was listening to your gentleman earlier speaking about the current events and the election and the state of Israel, I was here and I was jumping up and down and I was saying, hey, thank you, Utrice, because you came back at him with a dose of reality, because he was mired in the importance of these elections and how significant they were, and, you know, the sheer power of this state and how they're, you know, able to. Israel didn't even exist prior to the 1940s, am I correct?
Correct.
So,
but you know, I got a different point of view. I what he presented was an analysis. I don't think that he was taking sides or in the
sense that
he was just giving us an overview of what the issues were in this.
He did that. He did it very effectively, very succinctly. I concur. But the fact that it wielded so much significance in the minds of people, to me, speaks volumes. Because, and I want to make this one last point, because, right, and this is why I'm tying this all back together. This is why we know that Africans don't have rights. These folks who were persecuted in the war, this is why Israel was created, correct? That's why the World War II. This is why Israel was created. They take a few Euro Jews, European Jews, give them this land in a place where they know no Europeans were. Come on now. This is not a place where Europeans are indigenous to. There's no way. And this is the basis of the modern-day conflict. Now, juxtapose that against the 500 years that was the war was waged against Africa. The hundreds of millions of people that were either lost to the sea, lost to slavery, went out of their minds because of this war that was being waged on Africa. And then when they dismantled the system, they gave these people no state. They gave these people no wealth. Matter of fact, they didn't even give these people therapy, right? You can go to war now for 2 weeks, come back with PTSD, and you get all this therapy and all this kind of. These people, 500 years, their nations were being ravaged. And no therapy, none of this, no reparations, no sovereign rights. And yet they condemn the African for not having contributed anything to modern society besides love and hip-hop or, you know, whatever the entertainment industry likes to tout. Well, we know that's all a lie. But I'm trying not to be on a soapbox, I'm trying not to be emotional, and I'm trying to look at things just from, you know, kind of like a real rational perspective. And the more I do that, the more I'm convinced that either I'm losing my mind or the rest of the people on the planet are losing theirs.
Well, the answer is yes to both, actually.
You're probably right.
And that's where we all are. From,
yeah, absolutely.
We're all, in one way or the other, kind of losing our minds because, you're right, the system is so oppressive that you really have to be constantly reinforced in order to hold on to your mind.
And I appreciate this show so much because it is a dose of clarity and reality and like a sea of just madness out here, you know what I mean? And I'm trying my best to kind of like bang against the system within the system, if that makes sense. I mean, I'm trying to create jobs, I'm trying to start businesses, I'm trying to invest, I'm trying to do all these things that they say that civilized people are supposed to do in order to elevate. But the more I try, the more I realize that this system was not created for people like me to succeed within it. Because
with this realization, Mike, with this consciousness, let's say, that you have arrived at, this point at which you have arrived, what are you doing with this consciousness? I mean, what does it impel you to do?
Well, I think ultimately what it's revealing to me that there's only one solution for me and my ilk, and that is to try to reclaim what was taken, right? So that, you know, I'm trying to put myself in a position where I can reclaim some place here on this ball while I'm here to have for me, my family, and, you know, and those of like minds to at least try to create something that will be beneficial for us, you know what I mean, and for humanity instead of just a small group. That's the only thing I could come up with.
It's a great thing. It's an excellent thing. It's a wonderful thing.
That's the only thing left for me. It's the only thing left for me to try to accomplish. All individual goals have long since been achieved. It's not about that anymore. You know what I'm saying? It's about trying to basically put something in place that someone else can kind of benefit from when I'm, you know, long gone.
Now, you know, this is a very odd thing, that this is progress. However, it is returning
right.
to
yeah.
the original template. You know, because that's right. what your
right
forebears and my forebears did.
Right back to garden.
And
that's right.
just get right back to the basics.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
There's great wisdom in that. It is not about adopting this anti-human way of thinking and doing things. It is about returning to a core value that has sustained us. And this is the value of, the gifts that we have gotten from those who were subjected to unimaginable kinds of oppression. So I keep telling people this all the time. It's nothing fancy.
Not at all.
Going right back to where we started. And that, by the way, is progress. People say, well, you're going back. Yeah, we're going back so that we could progress. That's a fantastic solution. Thank you so much, Mike, for this instruction today.
No, thank you. Thank you for your show.
Thank you. And thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Harvey. Thank you, Joel, of course, for bringing all this to us. We do this again tomorrow so we can get some more voices. We're making up for lost time. I want to thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts and your ideas and your insights. This is co-education. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Patrice Lee. More tomorrow. Bye-bye.